Anyway, today the High Court began hearing the Marrow Council's challenge to the partial sale of Mighty River Power. Marrow Council has been joined in its challenge by the Waikato River and Dams Claims Trust and the Pohokuni Claims Trust. As I said before, the Crown appreciates the urgency with which the courts are treating this matter. Today's hearing is not unexpected. I've said before, it's been my expectation that court action would proceed, and it's good to see this step getting underway. I understand that the hearing is expected to finish by Wednesday or Thursday of this week. As this matter's before the courts, I'm not really in a position to say much further. Last week I visited Cambodia and Myanmar. In Cambodia I attended the East Asian Summit. While there, I attended a meeting of TPP leaders chaired by President Barack Obama. TPP leaders affirmed their commitment to conclude the basic outline of the TPP by around about October 2013, an ambitious deadline, but one that I totally support. I took away from the meeting the sense that President Obama is totally committed to getting this deal over the line. There was also broad agreement that it was important to keep our sights high and to resist the temptation to lower the overall quality of the deal. The 15th round of TPP negotiations takes place in Auckland next month. Last week, leaders' meeting will add real momentum to those negotiations. The issues under consideration in TPP are not going to get any easier, and concluding a high-quality agreement would send a useful signal to the international community at a time where economic growth prospects outside of Asia are looking modest at best. The reality is that the growth outlook for Europe is anemic, and the United States will be wrestling with the fiscal cliff for the next couple of months at least. Asia is where the growth will be for the next couple of decades. Our two largest trading partners, Australia and China, are forecast to maintain reasonable growth rates, helping shore up demand for our exports. Our government is well placed to take advantage of this growth. We have the FTA with China and our FTA with ASEAN, along with Australia, plus our bilaterals with Malaysia, Thailand and Hong Kong. We're also negotiating FTAs with Korea, Chinese Taipei and India. So at a time when some parts of the world, notably Europe and the United States, are still facing significant issues around too much debt or very little growth, New Zealand has the opportunity to translate its strong links in Asia into exports, jobs and of course other opportunities. In addition to the TPP meeting, I participated in the launch of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. RCEP is an FTA negotiation, including 16 of the 18 members of the East Asian Summit, including significant economies which we don't currently have an FTA with, such as Japan, Korea, and of course India. With TPP, RCEP, and our network of other FTAs, our government has New Zealand well placed to take advantage of the forecast economic growth in Asia over the coming decades. My official visit to Myanmar took place at a very fascinating time. Myanmar is in the midst of political reforms which have seen the country transform itself from a hermit-like state into a hybrid form of democracy with full elections scheduled for 2015. In my meeting with Aung San Suu Kyi and the present Thein Sein, I was conscious that the reform process is still in its infancy and how much support that country will need as it continues to undertake political and economic reforms. I look forward to welcoming President Thein Sein to New Zealand in December and encouraging the President to stay the course on his reform program, including through further improvements for human rights of those living within Myanmar's borders. As you'll be aware, today it was revealed the coalition airstrike in Afghanistan has resulted in the death of a senior insurgent leader who it is believed was responsible for the August IED attack that killed three New Zealand soldiers. I can go through a few details that I have for you. The airstrike was carried out in the northeast of Bamyan province on the 21st of November. The strike resulted in the death of the insurgent leader, Abdullah Kolta, and four other insurgents. NZDF and Afghan National Security Forces contributed intelligence, which led to the strike. I can confirm that no NZDF forces were involved on the other operations. Kolta was responsible for leading and coordinating a number of attacks on the PRT and Afghan National Security Forces, and the ISAF command authorised a strike to prevent an imminent insurgent attack on Afghan security forces. For any more operational details, I'd refer you to the CDF. In terms of ministerial activity, except in general this week. I'm in Wellington for caucus and question time on Tuesday and Wednesday. Wednesday evening, of course, I'll be attending the Hobbit premiere. On Thursday, I'm in Matamata for more Hobbit-related events. On Friday, I'm visiting Christchurch. On Saturday, I'm in Hamilton for the opening of the Te Rapa Bypass. And just in terms of House activity, this week the government intends to progress the Local Government Amendment Act 2002, the Advanced Technology Institute Bill, and the taxation and livestock-related matters, as along with the state sector and public financial reform bill.
That intelligence, did that come through the SAS?
Almost certainly so, yes. I mean, I don't have exact details, but that's the sort of work they've been doing over there, and I'm sure they would have contributed to the overall picture.
You said when they went back, they were going back for logistics, so they're obviously doing more than that. Were they working in Birmingham?
Pretty sure, if I'll go back and look at the various press conferences I did, but I'm pretty sure I said they went back for intelligence and logistical planning purposes, and that's exactly what's taking place. They've gathered information, that information has been passed on to ISAF, and ISAF have undertaken an operation which has seen these five insurgents killed.
Did that require them going into the area?
I don't have all of those operational details of how they did that.
But they could have done that?
They may have, I just simply don't know, but the CBU Port have an answer to that.
Can you be any more specific about the intelligence gathered, whether it was location or what was it?
I'm sorry, I just don't have that, but the CBU might be able to answer that question.
Do you know anything more about the attack that you were involved in?
I just know that there was imminent. I think they were in a ridge type area when the actual operation was undertaken. Again, for really specific details, you need to go to defence.
Do you know
if
it's drone or manned
aircraft? I don't have all of the details. I think it was certainly there was an aerial activity that was undertaken, but a combination of aerial resources used against CBU.
Who would have called that in? Is there any possibility that New Zealand troops would have called in the airstrike?
No, that was handled by ISAF and the Afghan forces. So essentially New Zealand builds the picture of where these people are. It builds the case that leads to the legal support, but the actual operations and the commanding of those operations are carried out by ISAF.
Who identified these people who killed?
Yeah, again, I'd be guessing actually, it'll obviously be sort of Afghan forces. I think they said you might be able to answer that. I know they're very confident that Abdullah Khalil was killed, and there were four other insurgents, but exactly how they know that is a matter of thing.
So is there a sense that this takes some of the pressure off New Zealand troops in Darien, that some of the risk has been alleviated with his death?
I think he is seen as a very significant figure, so he played a significant part in the IED attack that killed our three soldiers earlier in the year, and my understanding is this links back to the Tim O'Donnell insurgent attack as well. So he seems a very significant figure. So yes, I think on the face of it, it makes our troops, puts our troops in a safer position.
Are those SAS guys going to stay there then?
The mandate allows them to stay, I think, until the end of April. So at this point, I haven't been advised that they're going to come back earlier.
You talked about five casualties. Do you know if any civilians were caught up in this, were injured at all or killed?
I don't have any advice on civilians, but yes, there are five casualties, I understand, but I don't have any other advice on civilians. I haven't been advised that there were any civilian casualties. I don't think there was, because of the nature of where it took place, but maybe CBU could answer.
Would you be seeking any guarantees that there
weren't? Well, in the end, it's an ISAF Afghan missions, they have the responsibility for the administration of the mission. All we do is play a part in terms of building the argument and support and legitimacy of the case. But yes, of course, I'd always be concerned if civilians were caught up in these activities. My understanding is everything is done to ensure their protection as best we can, notwithstanding that they're in a very different environment. But I haven't had any advice that there are any other casualties.
If the families of the New Zealand soldiers killed those earlier attacks, have they been notified and told about this operation?
Look, I don't know the answer to that question. I suspect not, but I might be wrong.
Shouldn't they be contacted?
Defence may be talking to them today. This only happened very recently, and the way this process works is that, as I understand it, is that ISAF hold a weekly press conference. They do that on the Sunday, and so that's the point at which this information gets into the public domain. So, is possible. I think what the families would want to know is that we are doing everything we can to protect those soldiers that are currently now in Afghanistan. It's not a matter of retribution, but it is a matter of trying to make that environment safer for the troops that we have there.
It's not ideal for them to find out reading the media, is it?
These are military families, and they would understand all of the complexities of what goes on. And I think they have their loved ones had a lot of friends that are still either in theatre, so they would just want to know that they are in the safest position that they can be. So my sense is they're probably relieved of what's taking place, like most New Zealanders would be, I'd say.
What's at stake if this water rights trial goes against you? What happens if you can't get your timings in the government in terms of your overall economic program?
Well, we have no capital budget allocated in our accounts. So in other words, we are working on the principle that when we buy other assets on behalf of New Zealanders, we'll be using funds that we get out of the mixed ownership model process. So if we can't effectively sell those 49% stakes, in principle, we have to make a decision about whether we're going to go ahead and buy other assets. Now, there are some assets that we just need to purchase, so arguably New Zealand's debt would go up. And I think one of the basic arguments that we've had is, look, at a time where the world is going through an economic crisis, where debt is fundamentally bad, and actually, conceptually, where New Zealand households themselves are paying down debt because they can realise the fragile nature of the international markets, I can't see why New Zealanders would want us to add more debt than we absolutely have to the New Zealand balance sheet.
You still feel that there's enough time to get this through whatever four stages it needs to go through?
That's your advice up here.
Neither you ruled out this morning any negotiated settlement. Is that just after this case, or do you maybe for all stages of appeal?
Well, I think, I would mean all stages of the appeal, because the basic principle here is that the Crown believes it's right, and that is the Crown does not believe that the selling of shares in any way impinges upon a government's right to register rights and interests if they believe those rights and interests are genuine. And it's not about the wider interest of what is a genuine water right or not, it's about the process. And I can't see any particular reason why we've gone back away from our current position.
When you say you can get it through in time, does that include a Court of Appeal hearing?
And Supreme Court potentially, yes.
Could I ask you about the 100% pure grain? It's coming through a bit of a battering or a bit of controversy last week. Is it still working given that we're getting increased scrutiny of not being perhaps up to that, water quality and this?
Well, I don't accept the view that it's not working. I think you've had one or two academics in New Zealand who have presented a view, and I think as the Herald editorial pointed out this morning, some of them might have been either factually incorrect or putting the argument from their perspective. And I think people have got to be very careful when they look at like they're potentially running New Zealand down or presenting a position which it may not be factually correct. So yes, there are some waterways that need repairing and restoring, but that's why the government's allocated $250 million towards improving water quality standards. It's also true that the vast bulk of New Zealand waterways are safe to swim in. So when they look at those statistics, they look at the worst ones, so they measure all of them, and they measure them at the worst possible time. So, I mean, overall, 100% pure is a marketing campaign. It's like saying McDonald's, I'm loving it. I'm not sure every moment that someone's eating McDonald's, they're loving it. Maybe they are, but they're probably not every single occasion. And it's the same thing with 100% pure. It's got to be taken with a bit of a pinch of salt.
So is it you worry that it's being used counterproductively, like by environmental activists to
sort of
hit you back?
Yeah, but it's pretty limited, isn't it? I mean, if their argument is that we should have that we should be 100% pure, and by that they mean there's no economic activity, because by definition, cavemen burning fires, that has an environmental impact. Well, that might be a view of the world that they want to live in, but I don't think most New Zealanders would share their view. And again, having travelled around the world a lot, again, a lot of New Zealanders have. The one thing I know is when I fly back to New Zealand is how green it is and fundamentally how clean it is.
Does it help when your primary industries minister cuts across a legal case involving a local body and threatening to change their RMA if local councils come down too hard on farms in terms of improving water quality?
or the merits of the case that he might take, or the appeal that he's launching or is launching, is, you know, something for a wider debate. All I can tell you is that he has a view that the impact on agriculture would be very significant and far greater than the Horizons 1 plan proponents would argue it is, the merits of which would need to be sorted out by the courts.
Are you satisfied that he's been representing the statistics that his department has gathered accurately, considering he's using it against another department, being DOC, when you've got Gareth Morgan this morning describing it as intellectually sloppy?
Well, again, I haven't looked at every statement he's made, but you know, there is two sides to this debate, and he is representing the views that he strongly holds and are held by his department, as I understand.
Were you rational there in all
of any of the allegations about Brendan Taylor? No. Well, I don't think so. I first I knew that was going to pick up the SST, Mr. Moore.
The latest Linked Employer Employee data series is out, and it shows from September 2008 to September 2011, the number of jobs in manufacturing fell by a little over 20,000. Do you accept that? I mean, is that a concern to you?
Well, I don't know that particular data series, but what I can tell you is there's lots of different data series. So was that QES, the one you just called?
No, it's the Linked Employer.
Okay,
and it covers filled jobs, but the number of people in filled jobs.
Yeah, so there is always a range of different data series. QES is one, that's obviously another. Household labour force is another. All I can tell you is the consensus view, and that was the previous government's view as well, was that HLFS was the best measure of the economy. Sometimes it produces numbers I don't like, but if you look at their data series, what they're saying is, in broad terms, over the last 4 years, the number of jobs in manufacturing is roughly about the same. Slightly up, I think, but roughly about the same. So I don't know the ins and outs of that particular survey if you're quoting them.
But overall, all the job figures, aside from, as you keep on referring to, the number of people on the unemployment unit, but aside from that, they all look negative, don't they?
Well, I tell you what I think is that HLFS is a survey. So it's like a poll. So sometimes polls are right, sometimes they're wrong. I suspect when we first looked at the data, it really ran at odds then, both what every bank economist and the Treasury and the Reserve Bank were predicting, and it ran against some of the other data that we were seeing, like online job advertisements and what's happening with the unemployment benefit numbers. That said, about a week after that, retail sales came out, and retail sales was very weak for the September quarter. And if you think back to that September quarter, that was a period of time where there was huge turmoil in Europe. I'd just come back from Europe from memory, and you had all the issues with Greece. You had a period of time where it was winter in New Zealand, so again, that tends to sometimes slow things down. People just get a little bit more cautious. And China was really slowing down. So I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I just don't know. I mean, these numbers bounce around quite a lot. All the anecdotal evidence we've seen post that quarter is it's picking up a little bit, but let's just sort of wait and see. I mean, overall, manufacturing, if you look at it, there's been quite a move towards the outsourcing of manufacturing jobs. That's consistent with pretty much every, again, westernised democracy. It's happening in Australia, it's happening in lots of other places. But on HLFS, the broad data, as I recall, it was about 245,000 jobs 4 years ago. It went up to 255 from the last one. I think it was down five, so it's about 250.
Will you take any notice of the manufacturing inquiry that Labor, the Greens, and New Zealand First are conducting? Do you see any merit in that?
Not really.
Prime Minister, just coming back to the Māori Council, they claim today that all the time and money and court action could have been avoided if the government had sat down with them and discussed this issue. What's your take on that?
No, I just don't accept that view.
Why? You think they were always headed for court no matter what?
That seems like.
And what about the referendum? Greens and Labour are saying they've got about 320,000 signatures now.
Well, I mean, they're free to go and do that, of course. I mean, citizens initiate referendum legislation is there for good reason. It allows people to put it together. I personally think the use of parliamentary resources to build those numbers, is dubious maybe. But anyway, that being what it is, if and when they can get the numbers, and if and when the clerk verifies those numbers, then the legality of that's quite clear. The government has to hold a referendum within 12 months and it'll do so.
It could be around the time of the council elections.
Don't know exactly when we'll hold it.
Just finally on Labor's policy, their housing policy, Amy built tens of thousands of homes in Auckland for $300,000 each.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts there?
I reckon they're in fantasy land. I mean, basically, you probably can build something for $300,000, but not at the level of expectation that those first home buyers that would be hearing that policy thinks you can build. So it would have little or no land. It might be an apartment, it would probably be very small. And if you're talking about within Auckland, it would be, my guess is, a hell of a long way out, or a very, very, very small property. So that's one issue. The only places that we can really see we can buy a section for about 50,000 is around at places like Lumsden. And I suspect if all 100,000 homes would be built there, the price would actually go up. They're proposing 10,000 homes a year. Well, I think that was built last year, 535 from the top three residential building companies in Auckland. So in the end, it's as simple as this. The policy either doesn't reflect the expectations of those New Zealanders that think they'll be able to get a house under Labor for $300,000, or the policy is going to cost one hell of a lot more than $1.5 billion. And if Labor's track record is anything to go by, it'll be a combination of both.
Prime Minister, is abolition of US tariffs on dairy products your bottom line in the TPP, or are you prepared to see dairy excluded?
No, we're not prepared to see dairy excluded. And in terms of abolition, I mean, that's the aim. There might be a time frame under which clearly there'd be a phase out. But in the end, New Zealand can't sign up to the TPP if it excludes our biggest export.
What kind of time frame are you looking at, 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, that's all part of the negotiations, but it's been standard and some of the others we've done.
Has it reached the point where you've been able to discuss where your farm
apples are? Look, we haven't gone into the specific details. I mean, again, I've always been conscious of the fact that for New Zealand to do a deal, it's got to be on our terms and benefit New Zealand. Everyone has to give a little bit, but if we had to give away farm apple, then that wouldn't work for New Zealand either. So now let's have a look at how those negotiations go. I mean, we know where the pressure points are around intellectual property, SOEs, agriculture. But the one thing I would say is that my sense of President Obama is he's deadly serious about wanting to do a deal. And I can actually understand why. If you think about the options available to the United States, they're running massive deficits. Well, there's only so long you can run those. Their interest rates are basically zero, so you can't drop them any lower. If he really wants to stimulate jobs, then exporting and increasing his exports is one of the few ways through that. So my sense is he's deeply serious about wanting to do this.
Did the President give you an indication of how confident he is he can get it through the Senate and Congress?
Well, he believes he can get a deal done. So I accept myself that there are two things that have to happen here. One is a successful negotiation. We've had 14 rounds of negotiations and the 15th one has taken place in Auckland. The second of those is he's obviously got to pass it through the Congress and the Senate, just like we've got to pass it through our Parliament and everyone else has to ratify it.
Much easier for you to do it, though.
Correct. I mean, it is. But then on the other side of the coin, it's a Republican-controlled Congress, and typically they're slightly more in favour of trade.
Realistically, it's unlikely to be abolished in less than the 20-year sort of time frame that we agreed with China and Thailand?
Well, I wouldn't want to give away our negotiating point on all of that. I think what I'd say is that, you know, we go into those negotiations with a pretty simple message, which is we want a high-level comprehensive deal. Let's see how we go.
Maxine has put out research today saying that the newspapers were substantially biased in your favour in the election last year. I wonder what you make of that.
Really? Gee, are they reading the same things I was reading? Okay, sure enough.
138 pictures you got in the campaign last year.
Yeah.
Mr. Gough only got 80. Apparently you also dominated the column centimetres as well. How does that sound?
Yeah, but some of it, they were probably begging me. There was one or two instances I remember them writing quite a lot about. So, we'll see. Also, I think it would be a stretch to say it was biased.
Can I ask about David Bain's conversations? Right, so Cabinet considered that yet?
No, it hasn't considered it yet.
Is that going to happen this year, do you think?
I don't know. I know that the Minister's taking some more advice back to us when she can.
Prime Minister, why do you call Burma Myanmar?
what do we call Burma Myanmar? Oh, yeah, okay, so the previous government called it Myanmar. We moved to Burma because we took the view, actually, the one that Aung San Suu Kyi put up, which was, you know, that was the name that the people of that country had effectively lived under for a very long period of time. It was the then military regime that decided to call it Myanmar. So we've had a number of discussions with them through the foreign minister and the likes, and that is the name that the government wants to have, and we believe the government is putting its best foot forward to move towards a full democracy. So our view is that's the right thing to do. It's a small thing. The President himself of the United States basically called it Myanmar on Monday when he was there. And so my view would be, look, in the end, let's take the view that one day the people of Myanmar under a full democracy decide that they don't want to call it that, then I'm sure that'll be put to the test and they can go back to calling it Burma or something else, and if they do, the New Zealand government will call it by that name.
So it's back officially in Myanmar?
It is, yeah.
Bob Parker in Christchurch is concerned that although the demographics and ageing population in Christchurch have suggested having this combined tertiary institution in the middle of the city, what do you think of that idea?
I don't think the government would support that view. I mean, it would cost billions and billions of dollars to abandon the Island campus and Lincoln's campus, or I guess the CPITs, and put it together in Christchurch. It's a nice idea, but the capital cost of doing that would be far too expensive. I don't agree with the view that demographics are a big worry in Christchurch. I mean, there's been some reduction in school children in Christchurch, so who knows, but there's an awful lot of young people pouring into Christchurch because of the job opportunities, and that will get even larger over the years as the rebuild goes through. The government is very committed behind both Lincoln University and Canberra University, and also CPIT, and they are important anchors for young people. And our network review of schooling will produce, I think, some of the best schooling in New Zealand. In the end, I think it'll be the most livable city in New Zealand, and it's the gateway to the South Island. Despite all the claims that people would abandon Christchurch, leave, and businesses would not stay there, none of that's been borne out by the facts. So if people have got through the last couple of years and it's been really difficult to live there, I think the prospects for Christchurch are very great. And the concept of actually picking up Canterbury University and moving into town, abandoning all those buildings, all that infrastructure, is just beyond the stretch of government. Thanks much, Doug. See you later.
Yeah.